started exploring the database. Either Patrick or Amy, one of you, I think, said something to me like, I'm sure you can find some cowards amongst Kentucky soldiers. So that was sort of my invitation to get involved in this project. I am very much gravitated toward what I would call the anti-heroic aspect of the Civil War. In fact, the brief discussion had about fiction versus historical writing. That really has informed my approach to the Civil War since I first began in graduate school. I've always been convinced that particularly the public's conception of this war is really based largely on fiction and on romantic celebrations of the military and war itself. So that's what's kind of behind this whole project for me, and thinking about cowardice, particularly for soldiers in battle. And I can get into more about these aspects that are related to as far as desertion and demobilization. The other thing that I'm very interested in has to do just with the power of language and the specific words used to describe the military and the making of war. And this is something that Drew Faust recently addressed in her NEH lecture, I believe it was in 2011. And she talks about the way, the construction of war, that violence becomes war. And that really stayed with me as I started to look more closely at these questions of cowardice. I want to look at the words that I think some of us maybe take for granted as we look through these records, because they're so common. The celebration of heroes, the talk of sacrifice, and devotion, and just, of course, how those kind of words contrast with the reality of being a soldier in the Civil War. But I started out just by doing literally a word search, and I started plugging in words to see what I could find. And actually, I didn't find that much. When I used coward, there's a family, or a family, right, named Coward, which was really annoying to me. In the petitions, that was at home. And then I started plugging in some of the contemporary words as well that have fallen out of our lexicon today. Poltroon, skulk, well, you hear skulk, I guess, maybe. Some of these words that shirker, skulker, some of them would be familiar to folks that study this time period. And again, I really wasn't finding all that much, but what I did find were two particular documents, and that's what I used to sort of bookend my paper. And they're related, and Patrick was incredibly helpful in helping me flesh in what I, of course, it's still a work in progress, and what I'm trying to discover here about this one particular unit and their Civil War experiences. So I began with a poem, which I excerpt in my paper, and this poem happened to be written by a member of the 3rd Kentucky. Originally, this was the 1st Kentucky, but that's another story in itself. But they become the 3rd Kentucky. And in the words of the poem, the word coward was in the poem, as well as words like duty and valor, and of course, hero. And the context for this poem was, it was September of 1861, and the 3rd Kentucky, which had recently been raised, was in Kentucky, in Lexington, and they were accepting their official regimental colors. Also mentioned in the poem was Thomas Bramlett, and that's important because he's the colonel. So again, the context is that this unit, they're receiving their flags, and there's a celebration of all the great things they're going to do, not the things they've done, because they've done nothing, really, but what they're going to do. And that was really important to me in thinking about these questions, those kind of expectations put on soldiers. And Bramlett, who, right, becomes, of course, governor here in Kentucky during the war, I think he is unique. I think you said this to me, Patrick, right? How many governors, North or South, served in the ranks? And you mentioned like Zebulon Vance, but I don't know of anybody else. So that's intriguing, right? This connection between the political and the military. Well, this unit, just to give you a very brief synopsis, they're in Lexington briefly. They're there to try to protect armaments and put down pro-Confederate forces and sentiment. They actually will move all over the state. Once we deep get into 1862, this, in fact, takes a great toll on them as a unit. but they're not doing the things that this poem celebrated. No, they don't have any real brave deeds to talk about. And just to mention too, which I mentioned more detail in the paper, the author of the poem was somebody named William Marvin, who was an English-born 57-year-old shoemaker who wrote the poem. And I don't know much more about, whether he formally read the poem, but it was important enough that it made its way into the governor's paper. So the unit continues on. You get to Shiloh in 1862, and they were part of Buell's army, and they enlist Shiloh as part of their army or their battle honors, but from all indication I've looked at, they don't participate in the Battle of Shiloh. Their first real military experience, or combat experience, if you will, was at Corinth, the siege of Corinth, in May of 1862, which was a pretty demoralizing experience. It's a siege. There's not any sort of frontal gallant charges that Marvin talked about in the poem. In fact, people are getting very, very sick, and the Confederates retreat and give up Corinth, and the 3rd Kentucky will be part of the Union. I guess you could call it a victory there. Now they're going to go on finally at the Battle of Stones River in the end of 1862, where they have what we would call a formal, full-fledged experience in combat. And by this time, though, Rowlett's gone. He's resigned. He's going to serve as a attorney, district attorney for under Lincoln, and he will eventually become obviously governor. But Marvin, the author of the poem, which I found so intriguing, he's also gone from the unit. He's discharged, and it seemed to be a relation to alcohol. But the unit itself goes into the Battle of Stones River, and from the account that's in the OR, does what that poem said, performs well. Just really quickly, we mentioned some of the words used by the colonel at that time, who's named Samuel McKee. He talks about the unit so much so, he says, that he can't single out the brave. He says, quote, "Our men and officers, without exception, acted bravely, and to give a list of those who distinguished themselves, we give you our entire muster roll." Well, that's not true, right? Not everybody performed well. In fact, I could just find in a very cursory glance in the desertion records that at least 4 men deserted during that battle itself. Well, Governor Bramlett is keeping close tabs on this unit. There's some indications here. There's one document I found in the records where he talks about his close affection and his continued affection for the unit. And we get to November of 1863, so this is the last weekend for the second of the two bookends for the two documents I focused on. He issues a proclamation, and what's going on there is that Kentucky needs men. And the Union in general, of course, needed men. The war continues to grind down. This is in the aftermath of the draft. And the governor issues this proclamation directly talking to white men in the state and telling them that it's their duty to serve. And he says to them, it's not about home defense. They lost that chance. If they wanted to, make a point about serving to protect their families, that in some ways was long gone. But in other words, not to say it's not related, but at this point they need to serve in order to fight back the rebels, to go out into the field wherever that could be and not be concerned about necessarily staying in Kentucky. But in some of the words in this, and it's a very long proclamation, he mentions what he calls these old regiments, and that, of course, could very much directly refer to his own, the 3rd Kentucky. And he says, these regiments are now historic. They are ennobled by deeds of brave suffering and lofty heroism. So he's celebrating his units and telling men in the state, white men, you need to join up, and then you can be part of this. You can also have some sort of magical connection with what it's like to serve in the military. And what, of course, is also ironic about this is we know that far more black Kentuckians will end up serving for the Union than white Kentuckians serving for the Union. And I found this, and I think my numbers are off compared to yours, Ken, so I'll have to check on that. But I hope I'm right about this. I found this in Chris Bull's book, and this goes back to William Freeling mentioning that about 180,000 native white males don't serve either side. Is that right? So there's still a significant, it's still a larger number, right, than serve the Union or the Confederacy. And we know that there are more African-Americans serving Freddie Union in Kentucky. That's the second most state next to Louisiana. And Brownlee himself is very much against that. And he won't make that kind of offer directly to African-Americans. He's only making this to white men. So the tension for me, the interest for me too, is again in the words used, the language, the expectations, and then the reality, and how we find that, and how we come to terms with it, and how the men themselves came to terms with it. Because even in a battle like Stone's River, where they did, by all accounts, perform fine, they suffered 40% casualties. They lost their colonel, who was shot in the eye, or I think they're maybe I'm getting confused with officers, but they lost one of their officers. And this has repercussions, but it's glossed over by these kinds of words of honor and sacrifice and devotion. And they don't really tell us much about the real lived experiences of some more.